This week on Art in the Air, we visit with the founders of Tallamore Park, Clifford and Lisa Lee Peterson, a local artist retreat nestled in LaPorte County that offers a variety of year-round artist residency opportunities, open to scholars, artists, scientists, writers, and more. Our spotlight is on Lakeside Artists Guild Summer Concert Series in Cedar Lake with Andrew Anderson.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air, our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Express. Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM and WVLP, 103.1 FM. Our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at LakeshorePublicRadio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available on our website, breck.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our shows are available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for more information about upcoming shows and interviews. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight from the Lakeside Artists Guild. They've been doing a summer series of concerts. They just completed one, but they have several more. And we have Andrew Anderson to tell us all about what's coming up for the rest of the season down there in Cedar Lake. Welcome to Art in the Air Spotlight.
Aloha.
Hi,
welcome.
Thank you so much, both of you. It's an honor to be able to present and let people know about what we're doing. This is our second summer season. We started it last summer, and it went really well. I actually think that lakefront is one of the most beautiful places to perform there at Cedar Lake. They've got a great stage. You get to watch the sunset behind the backdrop of the performers. And I think it's unlike anything else in the region as far as the beauty and the a place to give a free concert for the public to enjoy. We've fundraised the money for our first two concerts. Our first one was last Thursday night. We did a water music concert, which of course included Handel's water music, but it also included Otis Redding's Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. Oh golly, it had a whole bunch. I'm not going to remember all the tunes that we did on it right now because it was a whirlwind getting it together and presenting it. But it was a great show. We had students from our academy come up and they sang the state song. If you know the state song for Indiana, it's On the Banks of the Wabash. So right. That was appropriate for a water music program as well. They did a great job. I think there's some video of that on our social media. So if you want to catch some snips of that first concert and get an idea for what we produce on these free concerts, you certainly could go to lakesideartistsguild.com. And you could also find us. We have a YouTube channel that you'll be able to get from our website. All of that's available. Our next concert is going to be July 24th. And that's originally we were thinking of an American Songbook, but then we weren't sure how many of our singers were going to be available for it. And so we shifted it to an American Soundtrack. And the idea there is that we're going to give you a tour of the country of America through time even, but also contemporary. But songs related to certain parts of our country and then songs related to certain moments in time in our country. And it's going to be a really neat mix. I have the quartet that led to Barber's Adagio for Strings. There's a slow movement from one of his quartets that actually is the original version of that. And we're going to present that. What else is
so
on that
Andrew-
one?
Andrew, you know what I really like? I really enjoy the show notes. How far in advance do you post those for each concert?
Well, a lot of that depends on Pat White, because she is she's the force behind our show notes. She is such a lover of the backstory behind any piece of music. And she does a beautiful job of putting it together. I added images to it for our program notes for our first program. Unfortunately, with our group, most arts organizations have what they're going to do kind of figured out months and months in advance. Our group is a little shorter time frame, so we're still assembling these programs. We're still deciding on some of the music we're going to put on, and then as soon as we get that set, which usually is only a week or two ahead, we will have Pat will have fleshed out what the program notes are. It's an exciting way to put something together. It requires you to be really on your A game, because you have to learn and prepare and rehearse music very quickly and very efficiently. It tests your ability as an artist to perform under pressure and produce at the highest level without a lot of luxury of time to chew on it. And so far, it's been a really wonderful thing for us to be able to do. That American soundtrack is going to be a fun little mix of all things American from all different walks of life. The next one we're doing is going to, and that, by the way, that concert is going to be July 24th, 5 p.m. You guys have my schedule better than I do. The next one is going to be The Fairest Isle, which is English music. And that's going to be a fun one. We're doing The Lark Ascending, and our violinist Rebecca Cope is preparing that violin solo. And then we're putting a bunch of Elgar on there. I know Ola's planning some pieces that she's going to sing on that are appropriate to a English show. We'll probably have one or two of the boys from Liverpool, at least one of the Beatles.
All the mix of music for the water program was just fabulous.
Yeah, yes, exactly. And that's what we kind of pride ourselves on that. When we do a straight up classical show, we try to do it indoors, just so we don't have to run it through a speaker. It's really hard to get the fidelity through a speaker that you would get from these 300-year-old instruments. When we're in the outdoor, we'll still do one or two, like we did Handel's Water Music there outside in the wind, and it worked out okay. On these programs, especially the free ones in the park, we really want to give someone a sample of what's possible with our ensemble and with that setting. So the August 4th is The Fairest Isle. I believe that is a Thursday at 6:30. And then our final show of our summer season is Seeing Double. And that's going to be August 21st. I believe that's another Sunday at 5. And we're going to be doing the Mendelssohn Octet on that one. That's the main, usually on these where we have a themed concert, we come up with a single piece that we build a theme around. And the idea behind the Mendelssohn Octet is it's a double quartet. So you have two quartets of musicians playing. And one of the things that's kind of fun to do with a double quartet is to have one of the cellos be a bass. So that's where I come in. I get to play one of those cello parts on a bass, which is very hard. Luckily, we know about that one already. And so I'm already practicing that one because it's going to be something.
Well, we appreciate you coming on Art of the Air Spotlight. That's Lakeside Artists Guild. Their summer series concert, July 24th. American Soundtrack, 5 p.m. August 4th. The Fairest Isle, 6:30 p.m. And August 21st, Scene Double, 5 p.m. at Cedar Lake. Thank you much for Andrew Anderson for coming on Art on the Air Spotlight and sharing what's coming up.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Thank you.
Larry and I would like to welcome Lisa Lee Peterson and Clifford Peterson to Art on the Air. They share the artistic, administrative, and practical responsibilities of Taliamar Park. Taliamar Park offers self-directed residencies and retreats for artists, scientists, writers, and humanists in a peaceful setting. The house is situated in the midst of a 350-acre working farm, which has been in Clifford's family since 1950. Clifford has degrees from Harvard, Notre Dame, and the University of Chicago. Lisa served as a professor of textile arts, art and design department chair, and designer and director of the MFA program at Purdue University. Thank you both for joining us on Art on the Air. Aloha to you both. Hi. Hey.
Thank you for inviting us.
Well, we'd like to hear a little bit about you, and Lisa, we'll start with you. Your kind of your personal journey. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about yourself.
Well, I was born in the territory of Hawaii, which might put me in Africa somewhere. my parents moved to the San Francisco Bay Area when I was three. And so that's where I grew up and went to college, California College of Arts and Crafts, University of California at Berkeley. I worked in the textile design industry for New York City before coming to Indiana, where I met and married Clifford Peterson. And shortly after that, I got the position as professor of art at Purdue University, where I was for 30 years.
Very good. And Clifford, tell us a little bit about your journey, too, and how, and then we'll even talk about your journey together. So.
Goodness. Well, I started out when I was three at the same place where I am now.
So beautiful.
Yes. I grew up in La Porte, and we lived on the farm, and I went off to school at various places. And I came back in 1972, I guess, and I was here for about 10 years until I got married. And we spent a couple of years here, and Lisa got a job at Purdue in textiles. So we lived in West Lafayette for
for
30 full years. We had two children.
So how did you meet? How did those universes collide?
Don't ask us that question. I'll give you the short answer. If Lisa tells you, it'll be a very long answer. I was an artist in residence in the Gary Public Schools in 1975, and I went to a national artist in residence conference at Notre Dame that same year, and I met Ruth Asawa, who is a well-known San Francisco sculptor, both fine art and public community art sculpture. And 7 years later, I ended up visiting Ruth again in her home in San Francisco, and I met Lisa at Ruth's kitchen table February 1st, 1980. And we were married May 1st, 1982.
Very good. So, Lisa, we'll go back to you briefly. Tell us a little about your actual career at Purdue, you know, what you taught more in detail, like things, you know, in terms of your whole artistic journey there.
Well, everyone said that I was the head of the textile department. It was a department of one. So I taught all of the textile media. So anything from silk screening to batik to crocheting to weaving. And so I did that. That was my bread and butter. But about 10 years in, I took over the graduate program and wrote a successful proposal that allowed us to offer the MFA in fine arts and design, and then administered that for the next 20 years. So that's what I did at Purdue, with occasional stints as chair.
Very good. And it's kind of tough to be in the arts in Purdue, which is largely not known for a heavy arts emphasis.
That's true. However, because we have a very strong design component, our program I think it still is, larger than that at IU. because IU is more focused on fine arts, and our program was primarily focused on design, industrial design, graphic design, interior design.
And Clifford, then tell us a little bit more about your art and your artist in residence and Gary and everything. So tell us, what do you do?
What do I do? Well, in those days, Gary Public Schools days, I was focusing on silkscreen printing. And working with the children, I developed some very simple methods where I could go into a classroom and within an hour we could have finished prints done by everyone in the whole class. But and then I segued from that into textile printing. But all along, I've painted ever since shortly after being in high school, and starting in Mexico and continuing in various places.
So Clifford, then, you know, your designs are very bold and colorful. Was that how you started out, or did that now that I hear Mexico and different things, I can, you know, I'm starting to get a picture.
I started out that way. It's hard to get back to be as bold and colorful as I was then, but I occasionally succeed. And then along came the computer. We actually went to Purdue North Central when it was North Central and took a computer course, graphics course, and we were on the Apple II about 1982 or three. And it was when you had to say, move one space north, move three spaces northwest, et cetera. We were moving this little dot in increments. And then, of course, along came the Mac, and we got a Mac fairly early on and did some digitizations of textile patterns and various textile-related experiments. But I've been often involved with the computer over time, and but always painting. And in the last 10 years, I've done a great deal of computer work with images, but I'm almost always start from a drawn or painted image and scan it and then transform it in one way or another through abstractification or combinations or multiplications.
Well, tell us about this unique environment that you have created. I mean, it's kind of like you're going home, Clifford, but your whole thing that you've just created, that you live on and off this farm, and you created a whole environment there. Tell us a little bit about it.
Well, we have in the middle of the 350 acres, we have five buildings, actually. There's an 1854 Italianate farmhouse where residents live. In pre-COVID times, we would have up to four at a time. Now we accommodate one person per floor, and each floor has a bathroom and a kitchen and two bedrooms and a common room, so they can have relative isolation from the other person if they wish.
Yeah, but at what point did you decide to do the retreat? That is such an, you know, so here you're at this house that you grew up in. And then what was the inspiration to open it up like you have?
Well, we built ourselves a living loft in one of the barns. And then when my mother passed away, we acquired my brother's share of the house, and we owned this house. And so we had two houses, and we wanted to keep the house in the family. And it's also really sort of the center of the farm, so it's hard to detach it from the farm. But we wanted to find a creative use for it, and we went to New York or Brooklyn and saw all these people running around, and the speed, the pace, the competition for space. And we saw a need that could be fulfilled here by providing tranquility and space and time to people who are in the arts. So we tried to respond to that need. And from a purely selfish point of view, we enjoy having a constant stream of interesting people around.
Oh, yeah. No, they are so interesting and talented. And so how did you come up with the beautiful name?
Well, I was looking at sounds, and I looked at all these dictionaries of Scandinavian language and Greek, and finally found a word called tamal, which I liked. It means earth in Gaelic. But I Googled it, and someone else was using it for a community in Great Britain. So I said, well, I'll look for something else. And I liked the TA and the M sounds and the A sounds. And so I was sort of going along, and we have a 13,000-page dictionary, and I found a word called talia, T-A-L-E-A, and it means like a cutting, like you would take a cutting from a bush if you want to propagate it. And I thought this was appropriate, and so I had the word talia and looking for my M's, and so I have talia, talia, talia more. So it just sort of flowed into adding the amor to the talia and making a composite.
So let me tell the next one.
Okay, Lisa's okay. Going to share the next.
So then Clifford Googled talia more just to make sure that it wasn't used somewhere else. And the first hit was a line from the aria that Leonora sings in Il Trovatore, Verdi's opera. And the entire line, it's something, di tale amor, something, something, something in Italian. And the entire line means a love, such a love that it cannot be put into words. And we felt that, well, that was appropriate.
Sure.
And it's a visually beautiful word too.
Yes. So, and we like taking it apart. Of course, talia means, to propagate a plant. Amor is the word love, but there's also the word tale in it. And we have, to tell a tale. We have many writers who come, and then of course, love, amor. So,
so yeah, I'm interested in, let's say I'm interested in coming to your thing, and you have different lengths of time and everything. How does that work? How do you apply? What's the expectations that I will get out of the experience and sharing and everything? So just kind of give us a firsthand knowledge of how that works.
Okay. So this has, of course, evolved over time. Initially, when we started out, we had scheduled residencies, and we brought four unknown people to each other into this space. And so you had a real residency experience. Our residents really commented on how they loved being mixed with the writers with visual artists and vice versa, because usually they would go to a writing retreat and there'd just be more authors, or they'd go to a painting retreat and there'd be all visual artists. So we would have these scheduled times, and so people would go on our website and they'd choose the time that they wanted. And Clifford spent a lot of time actually shaping the cohort, making sure that the people, had some common interests. And with the pandemic, that's all gone out the window. and so now we don't have a scheduled season because we're not trying to bring different people together. So you make a proposal either for yourself or for yourself and a friend that you share a bubble with so that you can share the same floor. And you propose a time. We have a minimum stay of 2 weeks, but we've had people here for 10 weeks. So it's really more, really even more self-directed.
I was going to say there was such a beauty that happened with this mixture because there were collaborations that were born from like writers and visual artists. I mean, that's what I observed when I was there. So. Yeah.
Yes, and I hope someday it'll get back to that, but we just don't know what the future holds for that. We are going to have two writers in the middle of July who don't know each other, and they'll be on separate floors, and so there may be some collaboration between them. We don't know. We don't micromanage them.
Yeah. Well, I have been collaborating with one of our residents, a Korean sculptor who has been here four times, actually, for a total of almost 6 months over the past 2 to 3 years, most of which was in the last year. And we've done extensive collaborations, including an outdoor installation on an old swing set. I mean, a giant swing set. It's about 12 feet high by 20 feet long by 8 foot wide. And she cut out more than 300 shapes based upon shapes in my drawings that she, out of galvanized metal and out of corrugated roofing material. And I painted one side and we left the other side exposed to show its rust and its age. And then she wired them all together to make almost like a skin or a roof over the structure. that's been exciting.
Lisa, you briefly touched on it, but we've been asking our guests this. How did COVID and the pandemic impact the operation? Was it kind of a shutdown? That's the first part of that. And the second part, creatively for both of you, was it a time that you kind of artistically shut down, or did you flourish?
We did shut down. We the spring of 2020, we were, about halfway booked, 50% booked for the 2020 season, and we had to return all the deposits. And it wasn't until the summer that we, you know, when things sort of got to some kind of level of insanity, we decided to reopen on this more limited basis. It's certainly been a very different experience. We find that most of our residents now are from nearby. They're not wanting to fly or travel great distances, and so that they're driving here. And we used to also, you know, in the early years, we had artists coming from all over the world, Pakistan, Ukraine, Australia, South Korea, Hong Kong, all over. Anyway, and because that they didn't have their car, we would drive them. We'd drive them shopping, we'd take them to the beach. And now we insist that they drive themselves. And so that does necessitate them coming from nearby. So most of our artists have been from Chicago and Indiana.
What about your own personal art practices?
I've been hyper productive over the last 2.5 years.
Yeah.
We don't have any visual artists coming, so I'm actually taking over one of our studios, the bulletin boards. I'm going to start doing photo prints of some of the images and try to organize them just to make some sense of what I've done over the period of time, which is going to take a long time to untangle. But I've been very productive and made a lot of creative breakthroughs, I would say.
And I have my artistic output has changed from making textiles to writing texts. So I've been working on a book for quite a while, actually. Finished the first draft last year and reworking it now.
What is the book about?
It's about three generations of women in my family. The oldest, my paternal grandmother, who was a woman that I never met and who was greatly affected by U.S. Chinese exclusion laws, even though she was born in the Republic of Hawaii.
Wow.
Well, so we're going to book a date in advance. When that comes out, we want to talk to you about your book. It sounds so magnificent.
It is.
I'm interested in coming there. Tell me about what the accommodations are like. Is there food provided? Do they, you know, tell us a little bit how that all works.
Well, people have to cook their own food. And several years ago, before we had moved up here, we were wanting to maybe have a weekend and maybe go to a bed and breakfast in the area. And we went around and visited several bed and breakfasts, and we came back and said, why would we want to rent a bed and breakfast? Our place is much nicer than any of them. And it really is. It's a very elegant house, large bedrooms, big common spaces, a huge, very eclectic library, air conditioning, so it's really...
So we have, you know, we have essentially two separate floors. Each floor has two bedrooms, its own bath, and a kitchen. So when we had four residents, two would share a bath and a kitchen, and the other two would share the downstairs bath and kitchen. So it's still possible now to have two separate parties on separate floors. Where was I going to go with that?
Just about the accommodation, the experience.
I very early on, from the get-go, I decided I was not going to try to feed them. That's not true. Before COVID, we did provide dinner the first night, just as a social event, and it was something else, you know, because this person didn't eat meat, this person didn't eat wheat, this person was allergic to this. And you know, we're hosting artists, and some artists work all night long and then sleep all day long, and other artists, you know, whatever. And so it was kind of silly to try and provide meals because everybody has their own schedule, and it works better, I think, for everybody that they can eat when they want and make what they want to eat. Although I know that it, some people don't cook, and so they don't, that's not so attractive to them. But, no.
Well, the house has a lovely deck and patio behind with wonderful landscaping and views in the distance. And we quite often will eat outside at a distance with our residents who are here
right
in COVID times.
During COVID.
You have extensive gardens too, right? Vegetable Ooh. Garden.
Well, not so much this year, but we have lots of gardens, yes.
And so what's the application process like to do that? Do they have to just go online, and then what do they need? And maybe even discuss a little bit about what the cost is.
Right, okay. There is an application, which is a fill-in PDF form that people who are interested can fill out. They can submit it by email, or they, if they're not familiar with email, they can print it out and fill it out by hand and mail it to us. We have gotten two or three paper applications. We do ask that visual artists send us a sample of their artwork. We have also had sound artists, so we get, you know, sound bites. And then writers usually send us 3 to 10 pages of their writing. And they also have to propose a project that they're going to do, even if that means they're just going to sleep all day. We fully realize that some people just need to get out of the, you know, the rat race of urban places. And it's fine to come and just relax. But no one has said that that's what they were going to do.
Very good. So real quick, tell us how they can contact you, websites, other information in our last moments here.
Okay. Our website is talliamorepark.org.
Okay. And you also have Facebook. I think Facebook Lightweave is on there. And you can also email them at info@talliamorepark.org. Clifford and Lisa, thank you so much for coming on Art in the Air and sharing your wonderful place. And hope artists hear about this and maybe get in touch with you. Thank you so much.
It's a beautiful experience. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM.
We would like to welcome Joseph S. Pete to Art on the Air. Joseph is a local author and an award-winning journalist for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Also, we should add that he is an Iraq War veteran, Sunday newspaper columnist, a poet, photographer, book reviewer, a board member for the Indiana Society for Professional Journalists, an IU grad, and the editor-in-chief of the Northwest Literary Journal. His latest book is Secret Northwest Indiana, A Guide to the Weird, Wonderful, and Obscure. It's a combination history book and travelogue. He has also authored Lost Hem in Indiana and 100 Things to Do in Gary in Northwest Indiana Before You Die. Joseph, Larry, and I thank you for joining us on Art on the Air today. Aloha and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an excellent show.
Well, Joseph, thank you. We always like to ask our guests about their life journey. I always like to say how you got from where you were to where you are now. So tell us about your origin story.
Oh, absolutely. I think part of the reason so much of my work has been so preoccupied with the region is that my family has very deep roots here. My great-grandfather had come over from Macedonia across the Atlantic Ocean when he was a teenager. He was fleeing conscription from the Ottoman Empire during World War I. And he ended up at Ellis Island, where he learned about like jobs at Gary Works in Gary. So he came to Northwest Indiana, became a steel worker, you know, walk to work at the mill and listen to opera in his garage. And his son, when the Gary schools were still operating under the Wirt system, his son, my grandfather, became an architectural draftsman because he had an aptitude for drawing. And him and his brother, they ended up working on a lot of the, back before they had CAD, where it was automated, computer automated design for architecture. They hand drew a lot of the architect's designs and worked on a number of projects like the Sears Tower, the John Hancock Center, the Houston Astrodome, the St. Louis Arch, the Touchdown Jesus Library at Notre Dame, things of the McCormick Place expansion, things of that nature. And they worked at American Bridge in Gary on some pretty significant construction projects. And then I was raised, my father and mother, they were both, or my father was a lawyer and a judge, and my mother was a teacher at Intran High School, and they were both kind of college professors. My mom at midnight, my mom at IUN, my father, he did night school, like paralegal training and that type of thing. Household was filled with books, read all the time. We subscribed to 4 different newspapers, the Chicago Tribune, Chicago Sun-Times, Times of Northwest Indiana, Gary Post Tribune. So I was constantly surrounded by words and literature and reading. They were very encouraged to reading. I developed like kind of a love of literature at an early age. I spent a lot of time camped out in libraries or like at the Highland Border, just, you know, for the price of a cup of coffee. It's kind of rent to just sit there and read all day. I would read as I walked. I always like to joke that I was kind of a pioneer with that. People now do it on their phones, but I used to, you know, read books while I was walking to the libraries in like Griffith, Highland, Munster, Hammond, Lansing. I would go all around Northwest Indiana to kind of always in search of more books. And I knew I kind of wanted to be a writer for as long as I remembered. And I ended up in journalism kind of because it was, it seemed like a day job where you could write for a living. I started working, went to the Intran where my mother taught, and I started writing for the Acropolis there. I think my first story was like on creatine abuse among athletes or something to that effect. But that kind of set me on the path where I worked at the student newspaper at Indiana University Bloomington. And I really started to pursue journalism as like a way of kind of exercising kind of the writing muscle, as it were. I think it was Ray Bradbury who encouraged people to write like a short story all 52 weeks of the year, because you can't each week, because you can't write 52 bad short stories in a row. I was just in the real estate thing this morning where there was a very prominent realtor in the area, and he was talking about the encouraging agents to call someone every day. And he said, it's less about the call than about the habit of doing it, because the world is ruled by habits. And I've always kind of believed that with writing, like you just need to have a discipline and just, you know, try to write, write something every day. And that's one thing with journalism. It's kind of forced me to be productive and to write, because it's very easy as a writer to kind of hold it. You know, you read like great literature like Dickens or Dostoevsky or George Eliot, and it's very easy to hold yourself to like an impossible standard of like a very high aesthetic standard. So to kind of overcome that, you know, fear of not like attaining greatness, journalism is very just helpful in getting me to kind of put pen to paper, write. And I ended up going to the after graduating, I ended up going to the Johnson County Daily Journal outside of Indianapolis, writing for there for several years. I wrote for the Sky Blue Window. It was an arts magazine in Indianapolis as well, on the side, covering like the First Friday Art Gallery openings and those types of things. And at the time, I was kind of really starting to submit a lot to literary journals, poetry, short fiction, flash fiction, humor pieces. I shoot some photography. So I really started to submit to that sort of thing and kind of honing my literary craft. I ended up kind of returning to the region to write for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And that really set me down. I've always wanted to be like a novelist. I've always, wanted to write, you know, the quote unquote, the great American novel or whatever. But it kind of returning to Northwest Indiana kind of set me on the path of really trying to chronicle Northwest Indiana with my books. Cause it's, you go to the libraries and you see the same books everywhere. It's like Powell Moore, History of the Calumet. You know, there are some fine books about the region, but for an area of its size and population and kind of historical and cultural significance, and you know, you find the steel made here goes into buildings all over the country, it goes into cars all over the country, it goes into washing machines and so forth all over the country. The area is pretty underrepresented in the history and literature, so that's one thing I kind of set out to, you know, rectify with some of my books. But I've covered Northwest Indiana for the Times for about a decade. I cover a lot of the art stuff, like gallery openings, some concerts. I try to cover other authors as much as possible. But technically, I'm a business reporter and I cover retail. But I just with the way the industry is, you know, the industry is kind of evolving into a more digital space, and it kind of affords you the opportunity to kind of do more things. So I'm able to do a lot of arts and features writing as well.
So, Joseph, in the background, do you have that novel going or a play or
I do have, plays. I've had a couple of short plays staged at the Detroit Heritage Theater Festival and at the Salem State University 10-minute Veterans Theater Festival. And I have a full-length one that I recently completed that I've kind of been submitting to contests and that type of thing. We'll see how that goes. I really enjoy theater. I frequent like the Goodman and the Steppenwolf in particular, and, you know, a lot of the local stages as well. But theater wit, I'm a big theater fan, and I just find theater to be very exciting to write. It's liberating kind of just to work with dialogue as opposed to, you know, with prose and description and other things. And I find with it, it kind of strips it down to its essence. And then also I find it where the characters kind of come most alive, at least when I'm writing theater, because, you know, when I write a short story, I was at an author signing and someone was talking about an anecdote where someone, you know, was got into a skirmish with someone at the bar and said, "I've lost 37 straight fights at this bar, but I know my time is due." And I, you know, it's be afraid of the next one. And then something like that. I hear something like that, and my mind immediately goes, "So I could transform that into a short story. That could be the basis of something I could flesh out into a dramatic story." But with that's where a lot of like my short fiction kind of emerges. Like it'll even be a news article or something, or a snippet or something I've heard, or an anecdote or something I've heard that I'll kind of flesh out into a full-fledged story. But with theater, I find I try to make it where the characters are sort of deliberately antagonizing each other, and they are, what's coming next is always unexpected. So they kind of take a life of their own, which I find interesting, because I don't always, a lot of the other fiction I write is kind of a little bit more structured. And I have kind of like the whole story in mind when I start out. When it's when I'm writing theater, it kind of goes on its it kind of meanders, it kind of goes wherever the characters will take it.
So can you give us sort of a synopsis of what the Detroit play was like? What was
absolutely. It was inspired by a short story by Charlie LaDuff, who's a journalist out there. It was about pickup hockey players in an abandoned building had discovered a corpse that had been frozen in an elevator shaft. And I've been long interested in urbex, kind of urban exploration. Like there's a lot of it that goes on. A lot of people actually come over from Europe to go to both Detroit and here in Gary to visit places like City Methodist Church, where they'll come and they'll photograph like a lot of the buildings. And I've always found that, very fascinating. I volunteer every year to help the Decay Devils with the preservation of the Union Station downtown. And I've helped with like the City Light and Water Building and to try to help preserve some of these historic structures. But I've always found that fascinating, given our built environment in Northwest Indiana and the way it's kind of been, you know, partly abandoned and everything, and the lack of reverence that's kind of often shown for these historical structures that in many cases were designed by, you know, masterworks by very distinguished architects and everything, and just kind of left there to languish and rot. And it's just a tragedy. I found that captivating. And that play in particular kind of was kind of a dramatic spin on the story about finding the corpse in half frozen in an elevator shaft in an abandoned factory.
Why don't you approach some of the local theater groups possibly to produce workshop your play? Because sometimes that's a great way to do it, get it cleaned up and then send it out for contests. I mean, there's a lot of local theater groups that might be willing to produce that.
Oh, absolutely. No, that's definitely something I should consider, because theater is one where I'm more kind of dabbling. I've been published pretty widely in short fiction and short humor or humor and poetry and things and journalism and things of that nature. I freelance quite a bit with journalism. I write book reviews for Ford Magazine and that kind of thing. Theater just kind of more, I just started writing it more out of a love of going to theater. So I probably should be trying to workshop some of my plays with that would definitely be beneficial.
Yeah. And we didn't talk about this ahead of time, but if you can think of something you would like to read, please think about that. We would love to hear something as well. I mean, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
Oh,
so
no, I definitely could. I could read from this book or.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Pick something and let us hear.
All right. I'll just, these are kind of short chapters. So maybe just a full chapter from, if that's.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Go ahead.
All right. From Secret Northwest Indiana, Tree Graveyards. The Indiana dunes are living formations of sand, always roiled in motion like the crashing waves along the shore. Dunes have been known to move up to 60 feet a year. The constant shifting of sand contributes to the great biodiversity by seeding pioneer plants in new places and by killing other plants off by exposing the roots, allowing the mulch to nourish the soil in a cycle of life. One byproduct of the Indiana dunes' ever-shifting sands is the tree graveyards, where thickets of dead trees jut out of the sand that left them stranded without any nourishing soil. Sand dunes have swallowed up entire forests. The phenomenon of tree graveyards can be found throughout the Indiana dunes, where it's not uncommon to see half of a tree's roots hanging out of a dune that's crept further landward. A few of the most dramatic spots include the big blowout by Trail 10 in the Indiana Dunes State Park, the terminus of the Paul H. Douglas Trail in the Miller Woods in Gary's Lakefront Miller neighborhood, and the Great Marsh Trail in Beverly Shores. Even in areas otherwise teeming with wildflowers, reeds, ferns, forest, and other plant life, hikers can come across otherworldly assemblages of dead trees sticking out of the sand. On the beach, old pieces of driftwood add to the eeriness. It's a spooky post-apocalyptic sight, but one that emphasizes how fleeting life can be, and even the sturdiest seeming oak is ultimately sapped of its vitality. The landscape of the dried out gray wood and bare, branchless tree trunks reaching up to nowhere as they slowly rot away can invite somber rumination about mortality and other weighty matters. But the trails continue to unfurl with varied plant life, like colorful orchids and sweeping seas of prairie grass. And the nearby sun-bathed beaches beckon.
And that's yes.
From Secret Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, very good. You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. I like the title of the one, 100 Things to Do in Gary and Northwest Indiana Before You Die. And I think there's a lot of things. So if I were to take that book, can you actually take that and like go ahead and use it as an exploring guide?
Oh, absolutely. It's part of a series by Reedy Press out of St. Louis. The thing is, if you're interested in writing local history, you're not really going to find a lot of New York publishers that are kind of interested in that type of thing. There are the only real two avenues you have are either like an academic press, press if it's a kind of more academic subject, or university press if it's a more academic subject, or there are local interest presses like History Press, Reedy Press, and so on. And they often will do series where you'll see these books all over the country in museums and bookstores and gift shops and that type of thing. And the 100 Things is kind of a bucket list series that Reedy Press puts out. There's 100 things to do in Chicago, 100 things in Indianapolis, 100 things in Minneapolis, Cleveland, etc. They have it for cities all over the country. I was inspired by former Chicago Tribune reporter Mitch Skirdick had written A Native Guide to Northwest Indiana, which I had really enjoyed reading when I was kind of away from the region. I would remember I'd be on the top floor of the Indianapolis Public Library, kind of looking out over the city, reading that book, and it made me very nostalgic for home. But it had been about 20 years since anyone had published like a general interest guidebook to Northwest Indiana, so it was kind of outdated. And I was interested in kind of writing a more contemporary version of that. So I had like looked around at various publishers, and Reedy Press was doing that bucket list series. It seemed like a good fit. So I pitched them on it. And it's in the concept of, like 100 different things you can do. It's varied. I try to hit up with that one. I try to hit kind of some more of the bigger picture items like Pierogi Fest, Dark Lord Day, the Indiana Dunes, the Northwest Indiana Symphony, the vintage baseball with the Deep River Grinders at the, you know, those types of things, the Brouwer Art Museum, you know, First Fridays in Michigan City, things of that nature. Trying to hit up some of the most prominent like museums and cultural attractions and places like the Tall Tree Arboretum outside Valparaiso. And, you know, it's just kind of meant to be a general guidebook to the region. I have a lot of the readers I've talked to at my book signings recently have said that they've used my books they've used my books to go and seek out new destinations across Northwest Indiana. Some of them have been photographers where they're looking to places to photograph. Some have been motorcyclists, which I found interesting, where they're looking for just rides to go out, an excuse to go ride somewhere. I've heard that too. When I covered a municipal airport, often they will, those general aviation planes, they'll just fly to go to a diner somewhere. It's just kind of it's more about the journey than the destination. But they just need an excuse to go visit, you know, this, that, or the other place. But I've one lady bought a copy for her daughter just got engaged and they just moved to the area. So she was trying to familiarize it with her and give her ideas for places to go on date night, things of that nature. But from readers I've talked to, they've definitely used it as a reference of kind of places to visit. The current book is a little bit focusing kind of more on the obscure Secret Northwest Indiana. It's kind of a mixture. That book was a travelogue. This book is a mixture of a travelogue and a history book. It delves into Northwest Indiana history. Prominent historical figures like Octave Chanute, Diana of the Dunes, Belle Guinness, John Dillinger, and so on. Henry Chandler Coles, where he invented ecology and like jumped off of a moving train to study the flora and fauna more closely when he was passing through the Indiana Dunes. And it also just gets into the general history of the area, like the Nike missile bases, the incredible biodiversity in the Indiana Dunes, things of that nature, the tattoo artist Roy Boy and Gary. But one thing it tries to do is it ties history to place, and it also concerns a lot more of the kind of off the beaten path and kind of hidden histories. Like I grew up in Northwest Indiana. I covered the region for a decade. There's probably more I learned writing this book than any others. I didn't know that there was like a German POW camp in the south suburbs. I wasn't aware that the National Dunes offices in Porter had previously been part of one of those Nike missile silos where they're trying to defend against, if the Soviets came to bomb the steel mills or Chicago, they'd set up a ring of posts outside. But there was a lot of history to the area that I was kind of like unfamiliar with. And this book explores both that and just kind of more of obscure and off the beaten path places, such as like the service sanitation has had success with these viral videos every year with the singing porta potties, where they originally sent it as a Christmas caroling card to their clients, and it blew up one year because they did a version of Straight No Chaser that found success online, and now it's something they release every year where they have them like wrapped to Snoop Dogg and things of that nature. But it's just kind of more of the, you know, the offbeat and obscure.
So Joseph, does any of your photography feature in the book?
Oh yes, this one is mainly my photography. I went to all the sites myself to do research and to photograph them. I went to all the sites in the book. I went to everywhere. The book covers a pretty wide geographic area from the south side of Chicago to the south suburbs, all the way out to Southwest Michigan, everything from Lake Michigan down to the Kankakee area. And I, went everywhere to historical sites, to sand dunes, to the World's Fair houses, to, various other points of interest. And it contains almost every chapter involves photography, so people can kind of get a sense of what there is to see at the site. Some of it's kind of difficult to capture because it gets into bygone places such as the Hoosier Slide, which once had been the tallest sand dune and a tourist attraction before it was kind of mined down to make ball jars and foundations for buildings in Chicago. But there's, memorials at the museum, the Maritime Museum there in Michigan City. The Ogden Dune ski jump, of course, is long bygone. It actually still exists. There was once a massive ski jump in Ogden Dunes where it attracted competitive skiers, including Olympic teams from all over the world, to try to set jumping records. And it's actually been moved since to Wisconsin, but there are just a couple brass memorials and so forth left in Ogden Dunes. But it, ties it to the Hourglass Museum, which you could still visit today, and that type of thing.
Getting close to the end here, but I want to see how COVID impacted you as a writer and things that you haven't done that you now may be able to do now that the pandemic is pretty much, in the rearview mirror.
That's a great question. COVID, I did end up writing a lot of this book during the COVID period, but when I went out and about, it was, a lot of it's outside or that type of thing. You're taking pictures of facades. So it wasn't a terrible imposition on the research for the book. The one area where I write a lot of local history, and one issue I had with COVID was I wrote in Lost Hammond as kind of a history book, and I spent it pulled up in the Suzanne G. Long history room at the Hammond Public Library. A lot of the libraries have since been closed or restricted access to the, or during the pandemic, restricted access to the history rooms. Some have been closed for the Indiana room in the Gary Public Library, I think, has been closed for a lot of the time. I have started to research a new book on the history of East Chicago, and that they have been letting me in the history room in there for that. But when the pandemic was in full swing, it was kind of impairing some of the historical research I was trying to do at libraries. But now I'm able to kind of return to that.
That's good.
And anything else besides that book you're looking to do outside of writing or next project?
My next project is pretty much Lost East Chicago, from the History Press. It's kind of a history of East Chicago, bygone institutions there, and the Indiana Harbor neighborhood in particular. I just continue to write short stories and poetry and so forth. And, you know, eventually I'm going to, I have several ideas for a novel that I've been batting around. But there's a couple more local history. I also want to, I cover the steel industry a lot. So I'm definitely looking to do a history of local steel, both in Northwest Indiana and South Chicago and the Joliet area, and kind of chronicle, the history of the mills and how they shaped the communities and brought immigrants from all over the world here.
That'll be wonderful.
That'd be great. Well, we just about 1 minute left here. And Joseph, tell us a little bit how people can find you on the web, your work, anywhere else. And
Columns,
presentation. Just let us know where they can find you.
I'm very active on Facebook and Twitter. I'm pretty much known for the Twitter. I can also be found on northwestindianaliteraryjournal.wordpress.com is an online literary journal I manage. At nwi.com, that's where most of my journalism is with the Times. I do the Sunday column on there, and that's where you'll find most of my journalistic writing.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate coming on Art in the Air. That was Joseph S. Pete. He's the author of Secret Northwest Indiana, Lost Hammond, and 100 Things to Do in Gary and Northwest Indiana. Poet, does photography, writes humorous pieces, and also does corresponding and journalistic work. Joseph, thank you so much for being on Art on the Air.
Thank you. We appreciate it so much.
We'd like to thank our guests this week on Art on the Air, our weekly program covering the arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. Art on the Air is heard Friday at 11 a.m. and Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP 103.1 FM, streaming live at WVLP.org, and every Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard every Wednesday on Lakeshore Public Radio. Thanks to Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio, and Greg Kovach, WVLP's Station Manager. Our theme music is by Billy Foster with a vocal by Renee Foster. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. We would like to thank our current supporters and underwriters, which include regional art patron Mary Levan and Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. So we may continue to bring you Art on the Air, we rely on you, our listeners and underwriters, for ongoing financial support. If you're looking to support Art on the Air, we have information on our website at breck.com/AOTA, where you can find out how to become a supporter or underwriter of our program in whatever amount you are able. And like I say every week, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good, and you'll feel so good about supporting Art on the Air. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world.